You are listening to Rights Up, a podcast from the Oxford Human Rights Hub. In this episode, we are exploring some of the key themes in Professor Sandra Fredman's monograph, Discrimination Law, the new third edition of which was published by the Oxford University Press in December 2022. Sandra Fredman, FBA, KC, is a professor of the laws of the British Commonwealth and the USA at Oxford University and director of the Oxford Human Rights Hub. Today, she is joined in conversation by Rosie Abella, formerly a Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada, Jaina Kattari, a senior advocate in the Supreme Court of India, and Helen Mountfield KC, a barrister practicing at Matrix Chambers in the UK and principal of Mansfield College, Oxford.
So we've been touching on what we mean by equality, and Rosie, you raised that when you were doing your report that you needed to find out what was meant by equality. And when you looked at the 14th Amendment, you found this adherence to a very limited view of treating likes alike, formal equality. But we've moved on quite a lot since then. And one of the things that I do in the book is to continue to develop a much more complex understanding of equality, which isn't only reducing it to one conception, such as dignity, for example, or such as equality of opportunity or equality of results, but which can bring in various different dimensions of equality in a notion of substantive equality. So one of those dimensions is that it should be an asymmetric concept, that we look at the disadvantage attached to having a particular characteristic or protected characteristic. It's not just that you need to be colorblind or gender neutral, as you said, Rosie, but that you need to say you can keep your different identity, but you shouldn't have the detriment attached to it. So that I encapsulate with the first dimension of redressing disadvantage as part of the notion of substantive equality. But that on its own is clearly not enough. And we've seen from our discussion of LGBTQI rights and sexual orientation that you could have civil partnership, for example, which addresses the disadvantage but doesn't address the recognition issues, the fact that people are still subject to stigma and prejudice and stereotyping. So the second dimension brings in a much more specific notion of dignity, being the redressing of stigma and stereotyping and prejudice and even violence, because violence reduces people to an object and doesn't recognize them. But also, so we've talked quite a lot about those two dimensions, but there's also the question of voice and participation, which I see as an important dimension of equality, the third dimension. And that's encapsulated potentially in the disability movement, which has always said nothing about us without us, but also the voice of the people who are really affected should come forward. And like you, when I was developing this concept, like you, Rosie, I did go around and talk to many groups, and many of them formulated this position that they are simply not heard, and top-down versions of equality are imposed on them. But also, it's more and more becoming apparent that many aspects of equality, of inequality, are not about individual acts of prejudice, but are about these underlying structures. And so the fourth dimension requires attention to structural obstacles and a movement towards transforming those underlying structures, which includes recognition of difference, accommodation of difference, but also not requiring people to conform to the mainstream, but transforming the mainstream as well. So in this four-dimensional approach, in which all of the dimensions need to be optimized, I've argued that we need to think about all aspects of, say, maternity leave, which we all work very hard for, which does redress disadvantage, but it also lands up entrenching stereotyping, because unless you have parental leave and paternity or other parents being involved. So what I have done throughout the book is analyze the various different concepts that we have in equality law under the prism of these four dimensions. And I was interested in your thoughts about this. You know, do you think that we can reduce equality just to one dimension? So, Rosie, in Canada, for a long time, dignity was the foremost paradigm, but that then in the CAP case and other cases was seen to be potentially more of a burden on litigants than an assistance. So I wonder whether we could have a conversation about a broader base for substantive equality, whether we can simply rely on equality of results, on dignity, on equality of opportunity. And perhaps we could start with you, Jaina, because in the Natisha case, which is the first case to recognize indirect discrimination, it did expressly refer to the four dimensions. And I wonder whether you've found it helpful to think of all the dimensions together, or you prefer to focus on one or another when you're taking forward your litigation or your policy work.
Yes, I think the four-dimensional kind of understanding of substantive equality is extremely important. And while I do agree that all four dimensions have to be used or kind of thought through together, it is not often that all of them are in fact used both for litigation by lawyers and also by the court. And often, or even if it is used, I think one or two of the dimensions usually take, precedence. So, for example, in the Natisha case, this was a really important decision of the Supreme Court over the last two or three years, where the court relied on your four-dimensional model. And not only did the court recognize the concept of indirect discrimination, this was a case wherein women officers in the army were not able to qualify for permanent commission as members, and the court recognized that the criteria for making them as permanent commissions was indirectly discriminatory to them because it did not take into account their requirements, and it did not take into account gender-related requirements, and it used this substantive equality four-dimensional model, which I think in some ways, it used the stigma. I mean, it relied on the stigma and prejudice. It relied on, it kind of, I think, also emphasized on the transformative aspect. But there aren't too many decisions that have managed to use all dimensions. And I feel one or two may be highlighted. So recently, the Supreme Court, the Indian Supreme Court, gave a huge decision on manual scavenging. So we have a very strong caste-linked discriminatory practice of manual scavenging, which has been prohibited. We have legislation to prohibit it. We also have constitutional provisions, both on abolishing of untouchability, on anti-discrimination on the basis of caste, but the practice still continues. And in quite a far-reaching decision, the Supreme Court, in fact, recognized this as forced labor, and in holding that the practice has to be removed, spoke really about the transformative aspect that equality can bring. And unless we look at caste-based practices in a larger way, that we have to ensure that we discard such discriminatory practices and we address the equal dignity and equal worth of people, I think it kind of really emphasized on the transformative aspect. There are other decisions on caste and disability which perhaps emphasize on the redistributive aspect, especially when it comes to reservations and affirmative action. So yes, I think while all dimensions are important to be used together, in practice I find that it's often one or the other at most times.
Can I say, Sandy, that I think the ideas that you bring in about different ways of looking at equality are incredibly useful in asking the question, what is equality? What are we pitching at? And again, coming back to the small c conservative jurisdiction I'm in the UK, judges, Supreme Court judges, see resource distribution really as within the purview of the legislature. They're very loath to intervene with it. But I do think you can use this framing as a way of forcing them to engage with it. And there are a couple of ways of doing that. One is, I think, through the approach of Article 14 of the European Convention on Human Rights, where you have the duty of states to secure the equal enjoyment of other rights which are protected in a democracy in the convention, and those include property rights because of the case of STEC. So then you can start and say, well, look, it's a positive obligation to secure equal enjoyment of whatever other rights the legislature, the democratic process thinks should be available. So then you have to recognise the situation of the outgroup. What is the inequality here? And if you look at that, you say, to secure equal enjoyment, you have to ask, what is the unequal enjoyment? To do that, you need to look at facts and evidence, and you need to get that from participation, because you can't know what the inequalities are if you don't ask the people affected by it. You can use that evidence to interpret the scope of a right in a way that you might not otherwise do if you're just using the black letter law. So you still have the democratic element. You still say, well, there still might be a proportionate reason not to, but you start from that assumption of equality. And the other way that, as a practitioner, I've been able to argue about some of these points, which again comes from your work, is by using the public sector equality duty, because again, it's a duty to think about advancing equality of opportunity. It's not a duty to advance equality and to foster good relationships between different groups. But then the law specifically says, but you can't foster equality of opportunity without addressing what the inequalities are and what you could do about it. So again, it's a duty of thought and consideration. And that really, I think, brings in that question of voice and participation. And I think it's really important that the law is engaging with the democratic process, but also saying these are values which the law has decided, the legislature has decided, should be protected. And therefore, that's the framing for the other policy decisions you make.
Yes. And of course, the public sector equality duty does specifically say, talking about removing or minimizing disadvantage, meeting the needs that are different, and encouraging participation, which was also adopted from this framework. Yes, thank you. What about the Canadian perspective, Rosie?
I want to touch first on something that Helen said that I think is really important, and that is, and everything, of course, depends on jurisdiction, where you are, what you're used to, what your history is. But I've been teaching in the United States for almost 2 years now, and it's very interesting, Helen, because the phrase democratic comes up a lot. And it seems to me, one of the most contested terms around. It used to be, when I was growing up, democratic meant legislature, checks and balances with the courts, the media, but it did not mean just what the legislature said. It has come increasingly to be condensed as a political theory with votes and elections. And that, to me, is a worrying prospect, because it merges what I had always thought were the multi layers of democratic, of the liberal democracy, which is not just what the legislature says. Anyway, it's just a side point, just because I've been hearing it so much over the last 2 years, and I feel like I'm having these endless discussions with people about, yeah, but if it's just what elections are about, then autocracies in Europe, like Orban, are okay because they're democratic, but they're not democratic as I had grown up thinking about it. But the other thing I wanted to talk about, your 4 points, I found extremely helpful, because as you point out in the book, context is everything. And the context of rights, I think, has to be understood as encompassing all of those factors that you're talking about, which forms the underpinnings of an understanding of what we're dealing with here, why it's not okay. By looking at these 4 indicia and these 4 contextual factors, we understand why inequality is not okay and why we need equality. But I think there is a way that equal is misunderstood as well. So I have always understood that equal as a sameness concept is actually a very important civil libertarian concept. There are contexts in which everyone should be treated the same. And that's, of course, what traveled across the Atlantic Ocean and landed in the United States, the civil libertarian model, where it is the individual's right to be free from the state. And there, everyone is the same right to fair trial, same right to vote, whether you are the monarch or the person who cleans the palace, right? You have the same rights. That's a very important civil libertarian context. What the Americans haven't been able to do, and a lot of other people are stuck in, is understood that that is a very different notion of equality than human rights. Because the equal in the civil libertarian context is an individual-based concept. Every individual has the right to be treated the same and free from an arbitrary state. Your human rights are your right as an individual because you're a member of a group which is treated a particular way, often to disadvantage. And you got to make the leap and understand that there is a different kind of equality. And what we're dealing with in the equality jurisprudence, as you've set it out with the four factors, is the discrimination model, the human rights model, which is different. So why does it matter? Because what is the context for women is different from the context for race, is different from the context in India for caste, for indigenous people, for persons with disabilities. Every context is so different, and you have to be aware of what the group is experiencing in order to understand what the disadvantage is. And I, you know, your factors and the whole theory of intersectionality is background in my head when I think of these things. But like dignity, if you set them out as factors to be identified by a court to see whether or not, and I don't think you intend it this way, to see whether or not it's being complied with, then we run into the problem of, well, you've got this one okay, but you didn't meet this one and you didn't meet that one. So it's factors are very difficult. We used to do it in family court where we had, here are the 10 factors to consider in what's in the best interest of a child. And we used to go through the list, age, family relationships, sibling, all of that stuff. And at the end, we'd say, okay, now what? So we've gone through the factors. So it's just an admonition that there are, what you've set out, I think, is a crucial and I would say indispensable context when you're looking at equality. But the test is a simple one on its face to me. And it's, does the law or policy, and I'm now reading from Fraser, create a distinction based on a protected ground? Does it create a distinction? And does that distinction perpetuate, reinforce, or exacerbate disadvantage? Well, that takes in everything, and it takes in everybody, and it allows for what you see as rightly the context. You have to know. And then it leads us into the tool we got from the German Constitutional Court, proportionality. Just because there's a distinction doesn't mean it's a violation of equality. Is there a pressing and substantial objective to the limitation? Does the benefit of the limitation outweigh the harm? So the balancing and proportionality is very important too. But those are the two steps that we engage in. And as you know, in Fraser, where they excluded women who were job sharing from pension benefits everybody else was entitled to, we said there wasn't even a pressing and substantial objective to it. Like it was just, it went from prima facie inequality to inequality. So dignity was one of those factors that ended up being a barrier to the possibility of claimants proving their case. Nobody knew how to prove indignity. And everyone alleged that their dignity was being violated. So in CAP, we acknowledged the preeminence of dignity and said it informs the whole charter. It's all about protecting rights is all about protecting dignity. So I wrestle with intersectionality. I did in Fraser because there was also a question as, is this a violation of parental status or family status? But if you give judges too many tools to work with, they're already dealing with concepts like disadvantage, which don't always make sense to someone who hasn't experienced it, isn't familiar with it, you're just going to add layers which will end up, like the dignity test, being a barrier to the possibility of the achievement of equality. No one saw that coming. We all cheered when equality was set out in the law decision by the Supreme Court. And then nobody won their equality cases. because they couldn't get past that first hurdle. So I say thank you for the four factors, because I think they are the context that is always relevant in an equality claim. But I also say it doesn't come into play when we do our actual analysis, but it is the indispensable tapestry behind us when we make these decisions.
Yes, thank you. So that is how it's meant to be. It's not meant to be a tick box of any sort. But I wonder whether then, in the light of that, we could come on to the concepts, the legal concepts of direct and indirect discrimination, because there is ongoing contestation that's dealt with in Chapter 5 of my book, as well as equal pay notions, etc. But as we said before, it's been a key issue for cross-pollination, disparate treatment and disparate impact, direct and indirect discrimination. And the concepts that came from the US across to the UK and then to the EU initially looked very similar, but have now diverged quite a lot. The United States sees direct discrimination as inevitably requiring intention. The UK has been very strong that direct discrimination, intention should have nothing to do with it. And the question for the UK courts is, the difference between direct and indirect discrimination is direct cannot be justified, indirect can, or potentially if the whole group is being excluded, that's direct discrimination. And if only a disproportionate number are excluded, that's indirect discrimination, which looks, again, very different from the US. So in Canada, the Canadian courts seem to have got to a point of saying these are pretty futile conversations to be having and distinctions to be drawing, and people's important rights should not depend on which side of the line they fall. So the direct and indirect discrimination in the terminology used is potentially the borderline between them should not be seen in that way, should not be seen rigid, even as rigid as that, and perhaps even the concept should be slowly merging into each other. So I wonder whether we could have a somewhat of a discussion about this here. Again, perhaps Helen, we could start with the idea of the ways in which direct and indirect discrimination have become very, have in the UK courts got very hard boundaries, and you have to make a decision about one or the other. Whereas even in the European Union and certainly under the European Convention, there seems to be more of a fluidity as to it might be this or that. And I wonder what you think about the need for a distinction, whether indirect discrimination has value as a separate concept, or whether there should be more flexibility as between them.
It was a very valuable concept to come into discrimination or at all, because I think when, you know, in the 60s, when we got our first discrimination, anti-discrimination statutes in the UK, that was a novel borrowing from the US, which might otherwise have been literally, unless you said you cannot have this job because you are a woman, you cannot have this job because you are black. There was no problem, and things like job sharing and part-time work and structural discrimination would just never have come into it at all. But it is a very clear boundary, and that was established in the Jewish Free School case, where the question was, if you, for religious reasons, decide that you have to be recognised as Jewish in a particular way to acquire a place at a school, is that direct or indirect discrimination? And it was ultimately decided that it was direct discrimination and therefore couldn't be justified unless there was a statutory justification. And it was one of the things that the court suggested. It might be that there is a statutory justification for that. Other faith schools have justifications. It might be there, but it isn't. So we haven't got the tool to say anything other than that it is direct discrimination and it is therefore unlawful. But I don't think it's quite as simplistic as saying that with direct discrimination it can't be justified and with indirect it can be justified, because there are justifications, quite a few justifications for direct discrimination, but they're statutory. They're in relation to single-sex schools, for example. It's in the schedule to the Equality Act. In relation to some forms of affirmative action, it's in Section 158 of the Equality Act. So I think it's that's the distinction. And I think as lawyers have started to use human rights concepts to inform the interpretation of equality law, and in particular this idea of securing equal enjoyment from Article 14 of the Convention, I think the idea of what can and can't be justified has started to blur. And I think if we had a clear idea that inequality could come from something, even that something was facially neutral, but which had an indirectly discriminatory effect, then I don't see a particular reason why you ought to always have to have a statutory justification defence to allow for justification of direct discrimination. It might be that there are contexts where direct discrimination can just be justified because there's a proportionate reason for it, usually in the context of affirmative action, I would suggest. It's just not the structure or the framing we have at the moment.
And what about in India, Jaina? Because indirect discrimination has only just arrived, in a way, through the Nitisha decision, as we've been discussing. So do you see it maybe getting caught up in all these knotty questions of which side of the line does a particular action fall? Or can you see the Indian Supreme Court seems to recognise systemic, substantive discrimination all in the same breath as indirect discrimination, maybe see it in this broader context of imbalance of power and advantage rather?
And I think the Nitisha decision was quite interesting because the court not only relied on different conceptualizations of direct and indirect discrimination, looked at Canada, South Africa, the US, the UK as well. And it also relied on your four-dimensional conceptualization of substantive equality. It recognized for the first time indirect discrimination, which was a real big contribution because I think till then our equality and anti-discrimination jurisprudence did not really consider direct and indirect. We only looked at substantive equality. The court took the view that intention was not important. It kind of leaned a bit the way the UK did. But then it also looked at systemic discrimination and said merely looking at direct and indirect discrimination is not going to be enough. It is not going to get us anywhere unless we look at deep-rooted systemic or structural discrimination and how structures are inherently discriminatory. And I think it moved on from systemic discrimination also to, as you said, developing a much more richer understanding of substantive equality to say that therefore, once we look at direct and indirect discrimination, we look and recognize that there is systemic discrimination, then the obligation lies on, in fact, addressing it and not merely just recognizing it. And therefore, there's an obligation on the state and on the courts to frame remedies so that the systemic discrimination is removed. And therefore, then what are the positive obligations? What kind of remedies can be framed? Can you provide entitlements? Can you change the structure, whether it's in employment or in any other context? And so it moved from direct, indirect, systemic, and thereafter back to substantive equality and positive obligations. And so I think it's quite a full circle, and these pit stops along the way will help in framing a much richer conceptualization of substantive equality.
Thank you. And how about in Canada? So, you know, as we've seen, the court is now skeptical of rigid dividing lines between direct and indirect discrimination. So, Rosie, do you see that there is still value in having separate concepts, or do you see a much more, you know, holistic approach being more appropriate? Or does indirect discrimination still have something to bring in the idea of it being a neutral criterion which has a disparate impact?
I don't see any value in the distinction at all. I think it was the Mayorin decision in 1999, where the Supreme Court of Canada first said there's really no point. We used to get tangled up in jurisprudential knots about whether it was direct or whether it was indirect. And it finally occurred to people, there are many people who don't intend to discriminate, but the impact is discriminatory, or they intend not to discriminate and the impact is discriminatory. So we just said it's not intention, it's impact. And I think that works because if you have a separate test, first of all, you have to go through the analysis of whether there's intention or not. Does it matter whether people intended to pay women less, or doesn't it? I mean, if the impact is they're paid less, then that is arguably prima facie inequality or discrimination. So twisting ourselves in mental knots over whether it's direct or indirect and what the test should be, I don't find very helpful in getting at what the issue is, as you say. So I am very comfortable with the approach. And again, it goes back to Griggs in 1971, where he talked about the built-in headwinds. That was a company that had a policy. A high school diploma sounded good on the surface. Canadian oil companies in the north had a grade 9 requirement. It wasn't an intention to discriminate, but the impact was in Griggs that blacks were excluded from jobs that required no training. Action Travail in Canada, where women were excluded from jobs that did not require any training. And, you know, if it's not job related, what's the point anyway? So the question is impact on a person who is disadvantaged and whether or not the distinction that's made has a discriminatory impact because it's arbitrary and all of the usual reasons. And I think once again, the Americans who are very good on their Title VII jurisprudence like Griggs, their human rights jurisprudence, but can't make the leap into their equality jurisprudence. We've merged the two of them and we see equality as understanding that not every distinction is discrimination. If you read, you quoted Chief Justice Roberts when he said to get past racism, you have to ignore race. And that, of course, goes back to the line in Backe where Harry Blackman said, to get past racism, you have to take race into account. So I'm in the, you have to take race into account rather than the other approach, which says it's not discriminatory, because you shouldn't take race into account. In other words, what are we talking about here? We're talking about people who are excluded based on their difference and their identity. Who cares whether it's because somebody wanted them to be excluded? Isn't the only significant point what the impact is of the particular policy or law? I think, again, this is something we learned from the United States what not to do. We somehow, I mean, I give the Supreme Court of Canada in the first decade all the credit. They just glommed onto the human rights jurisprudence and said, that's what equality is. They ran with it. So we didn't get stuck with any of those calisthenics that require, is it this, is it that? Is it keeping people out unfairly based on their identity? On face simple, not simple, but a lot easier than how did it get there? What did they mean? What did they intend? And of course, that brings in affirmative action, which we'll get to, I suspect, which is all about making distinctions and treating people differently. And the Americans can't handle it. They can't handle it as a group remedy because they can't handle it as a concept, treating people differently to acknowledge their differences. Anyway, that's a long way of saying I don't find it helpful, Sandra. And the court hasn't used it in Canada for almost 40 years, and no one has yet shown us that we are wrong to take a holistic approach to just looking at whether people are being kept out, what the impact is, rather than what policymakers or employers intended.
Rights Up is brought to you by the Oxford Human Rights Hub. The executive producer is Megan Campbell. This episode was produced and edited by me, Sophie Smith, and hosted by Professor Sandra Fredman. Music for this series is by Rosemary Allman. Show notes have also been written by me, Sophie Smith. Subscribe to this podcast wherever you like to listen to your favorite podcasts.